Text 51551. The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
My next guest has written over 50 books, including the best-selling teen spy series Alex Rider, which is estimated to have sold 21 million copies worldwide. Anthony Horowitz has written The Midsummer Murders, Foyle's War and others for TV. He was commissioned by the Ian Fleming Estate to write continuation novels for James Bond. His novel Magpie Murders was serialised for a successful TV drama. I could go on and on and on. His latest series featuring Detective Hawthorne and a sidekick called Anthony Horowitz, you heard me right, is now on book five. It's called Close to Death, and Anthony is on the line now. Good afternoon, Anthony.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Yeah, congratulations on the book, your 50th book. I really enjoyed it. It's a great read, very entertaining, and that's what it's all about for you.
Well, certainly. Thank you for that, Ray. That's nice to hear at the start of an interview. A good sign of things to come. But, yeah, of course. I mean, I write books that have one aim, really, which is to entertain. And by that, I mean to beguile, to trick, to tease, to cause, you know, surprise. But above all, to entertain. And that's why the murder mystery sort of world it so appeals to me, because it gives me free rein to do pretty much what I want.
Yes, including putting yourself in it.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, that was a sort of a big decision at the start of this. I mean, the Close to Death is number five in the series.
Yes, yeah.
And I remember that when I pitched the idea to my publishers for number one, which was called The Word is Murder, they were very nervous about it. They thought, are you going to use this character sort of to sell your books, to sell your life, to pick, you know, to settle scores with people? You know, what's going on here? But in fact, I said, no, don't worry. I'm just going to be the narrator. I'm just going to be me, as me. Everything you read in the books about me is sort of true, except for my strange life with this character called Daniel Hawthorne. And in fact, as the books have continued, the publishers have said, we want more of it. We love this banter between the two of you, the fact that he dislikes you so much and doesn't trust you, and you always end up in hospital with a knife in you and all these terrible things happen to you more.
Yeah.
So it does seem to be working.
Will you explain it to people who haven't read it? So it is you, as in you arrive to some of the people, fictional characters in the book, with a copy of a book that you've actually written as a present.
That is absolutely correct. I mean, one of the episodes, one of the books that I wrote, I remember, began with filming Foyle's War, and and there's this sort of blaring sound of a car arriving, a taxi with horn going, and it's Hawthorne, who's just driven onto the set in the middle of a shot. So I am mixing the real world that I inhabit, sort of Foyle's War and publishing books, with these sort of curious crime stories.
Yeah. So it's I suppose, in theatre, they would say you've broken the fourth wall.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, really what it is, it's, I think in the world of books, they call it metafiction, where you not only write a whodunit and hopefully have all the surprises, the suspects, the twists and the turns and all the rest of it, but in which you can also discuss the very nature of whodunits, where you're in a book and talking about the book at the same time. And, you know, it allows me to ask sort of questions that might sort of, you know, have fascinated me for years. Like, for example, why does anybody read about murder? If murder happens in your street or in your home, it is something shocking and horrible. If it happens in a book, it's entertainment. What's going on?
And what answer did you come up with?
I'm not sure I did come up with an answer, actually. I think I'm still working towards it. But these are questions which I do enjoy asking. I can answer, for example, why it is that we enjoy murder. I think that murder stories are not, first of all, about murder. They're about character. They're about people. You know, somebody murders somebody else for a reason. It's motive that always gets me going. Motive is my motive for writing, if you like. And nobody gets killed because somebody is a little bit cross with them or a little bit scared of them. The emotions have to be big, and that's exciting. So, you know, a murder is a great way to sort of punch your way through a wall or to tear down the net curtains or whatever and get into people's lives. But I think the real reason why murder mystery, above all other genres, is so popular at the moment is because it provides absolute truth. In a world with social media, with conspiracy theories, with 24-hour news, where nothing is actually quite nothing can be quite agreed, there is no truth anymore. We have something called post-truth, which is sort of not truth. But in a murder mystery, you get a community that was at war, you get a mystery that has happened, but at the end of it, you get that wonderful moment where everything is explained and everything is put to right. And I think that's what we need in this day and age.
Yeah, and it's right at the final paragraph, which is great. You don't waste one page in the book. I just go back to this, because I'm new to this self-insertion. I looked it up. That's what they call it in literary circles, that you're guilty of self-insertion. It sounds a bit painful.
It sounds like something that put you in hospital.
So for example, you have a discussion with one of the characters in the book about what the book should be called.
That's absolutely correct, because in this, I should explain what's in this fifth book in the series. It's a little bit different, because it's a cold case. Having written four of these books, I wanted to sort of just play with the formula a little bit and do something a little bit different. So this time it's a cold case that happened 5 years ago. I am writing it now, and I'm arguing with Hawthorne, who is the detective, what actually happened at the time. And you're quite correct. I then go back to the murder scene 5 years later. Everybody has gone, except I do find one character, and we discuss his view of what happened all those years ago as I am trying to solve the crime on my own without Hawthorne. So it is sort of, to anybody listening, they must be thinking, gosh, this sounds completely impossible. But actually, when you read it, the funny thing is, I do think it sort of works.
It does work. It worked for me. As I say, I really enjoyed it. What would life be for you, Anthony Horowitz, without writing?
Gosh, pretty empty, if you want the honest truth, in one word. I mean, it's been my life. I mean, writing is all I've ever done since the age of 10. It's all I've ever wanted to do. It's all I'm good at. It's all I really love. I always say I'm never actually happy unless I have a completely happy, unless I have a fountain pen in my hand and a piece of paper in front of me. I was born to be a writer, I think. And I discovered at a very, very early age that's what I wanted to do. And if I didn't write, I mean, I am very, very lucky. I'm aware of the fact that, you know, I live by my writing and I have been successful as a writer. I would have done it anyway. I would never have stopped. But so I am really very, very fortunate. And if I couldn't write, if I didn't write, I don't know. I mean, I would love to have been a teacher. I'm not sure I'm clever enough to be a teacher. I'd have loved to have worked in theatre, though if you've read the last book I wrote, The Twist of a Knife, which is about my attempts to work in theatre, that ended fairly disastrously.
Because you've written a number of plays.
I have, but they've always divided the critics 50-50. Right. Half of them hate them and half of them loathe them. So it's it hasn't exactly been a big success, my theatrical career. But you know, one thing I'm trying to do, especially as I get older, is to sort of to test myself, to challenge myself, to step outside my comfort zone. I will write another play soon. I will try and do other things. I'm writing TV and films. I'm even writing poetry now. So, you know, I'm trying to do things differently.
And what genre of novel would you like to write that you haven't written already?
Well, I have a couple of ideas in my head, as a matter of fact. I have a very, very big historical novel. It's going to be about 200 and something thousand words long. It's a very, very
big... How many
big,
pages is that?
That would be about 700 or 800 pages. Okay. I mean, a really, really big novel. If I am spared, if I still have a time... I'm planning to do 12 Hawthorns, so, you know, I am sort of running
another
out of
seven.
Time.
Another seven Hawthorns.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of writing to do, but there you are, so that's one. I have a sort of a strange sci-fi sort of thriller mystery story, which I'd like to write as well, which has been in my head now for quite a few years. Mm. And so, you know, there are... I hope, a few surprises in me.
And these worlds you create as a writer, do you do a lot of research?
Depends on the book. Yes, I do, generally. I mean, for an Alex Rider book, I'll do an enormous amount of research because those are in the sort of world of high tech and stuff which I don't really understand, and I need to be able to do that. For when I wrote the Sherlock Holmes and the Bond novels, Bond in particular took enormous research because it was actually quite difficult to write because every sort of 10 words, you'd come upon something which was set in 1963, and so, you know, Bond would order a whiskey. Well, what whiskey was around at that time? Uh-huh. Did he drink whiskey? Would he drink whiskey? Yes. Does he drink whiskey in the books? If he puts on a tie, what shape is it,
right.
Who is the designer, etc, etc, every last detail.
What about his relationship with women?
Well, that didn't take a great deal of research. I mean, happily married for 36 years, so I can sort of imagine it without having to do too much research on that one.
But thanks for asking.
What
was acceptable in the 1960s?
Well, that's is, of course, the question writing Bond about what, you know, attitudes to women and attitudes to different ethnicities and all those sorts of things. You know, political correctness, as it was called then, woke as it's called now.
Yes.
And I have always been sort of fairly, sort of, you know, straightforward about this. I don't set out to offend. There's no real point in offending my readers, but at the same time, I defend the right of any other writer who wishes to offend anybody.
Okay.
I think writers should write what they want to write and take the consequences if they're so minded. What I don't like about the cancel culture that we're living in now is the violence sometimes of the reaction to words, to books and to ideas. We should just learn to live with and tolerate what people think.
Do you think that's going to happen?
Yes, I do think that by and large the pendulum has swung very far one way, which is sort of the right thing to happen. You know, I'm not against a lot of the things that people who are supposedly, in inverted commas, woke propose. I think it is great now that you cannot make a joke about somebody's ethnicity without looking ridiculous and old-fashioned and wrong. I think it is great that we effectively have respect for each other, which is what woke is asking for. What I take exception to, as I've said, is the reaction to people who step out of line. That is wrong.
Yeah, and that gets lost, doesn't it? Yeah, but hopefully you're right, and the pendulum has swung over there, and it's going to come back and settle in the middle, because the middle of the road is often the best place to be.
Well, I think that not many people are actually very happy about what's happening at the moment, even the people who are on one or the other side of the argument. I don't think anybody is actually getting any benefit from it.
I was reading and listening to interviews you've done, and you were at boarding school, and you talk about you were born into a very wealthy family. And I'm looking at the Kenworthies in your new book, Close to Death. And did you draw from your early life experience for writing them?
No, not really. I mean, Kenworthy has some aspects of my life. All my characters do. But, you know, yeah. I have used my childhood and my schooling and my family, particularly my early children's books. That was sort of... And I still think that that's the fire, if you like, that sort of keeps my turbines moving and keeps me writing, you know, yeah. Sort of what I went through. It's a very strange thing to complain when you have had a very privileged and wealthy upbringing, to sit around and complain. Some of your listeners may think, you know, I should be so lucky. But actually, it was very emotionally damaging, particularly my schooling and my strange family. And I think that was very much part of the fire that turned me into a writer.
Yeah. We hear an awful lot about breaking the cycle. You've broken the cycle. Because oftentimes when people have a rough childhood, then oddly, because it seems a little bit perverse, they inflict the same... you know, pain on their own children, and thus the cycle continues.
Well, if I may say it in a polite way, they muck you up, your mum and dad.
Yes,
they may
yes.
not mean to, but
Philip
they
Larkin,
do.
Yes,
indeed
yeah.
so. It's one of the greatest poems, and it's my favourite poem of all, I think,
yeah.
and it is absolutely true. But our parents have only been damaged by their parents, and they pass
yes,
on the heart.
Yes.
And I think it is true to say that with my two sons, Nick and Cass, I have broken that cycle. We are a very, very close family. I would hope that in 20, 30 years' time, if they are speaking on the radio to you or to anybody else, they won't say horrible things about
yeah.
me. But I don't think they will. We have always been close as a family. And I think, you know, even above my writing, it is the one thing that I value most is that I have had such a wonderfully supportive wife and family around me at all times. Mm.
And Cass is a special advisor to the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Rishi Sunak.
He is indeed, yes.
A big job.
It is a big job. He's handled it now for 2 years and it is a very, very difficult time for him.
Mm. So what are the, when they're over for dinner, what are the chats like around your dinner table?
I will tell you the one thing we never talk about, and it will disappoint you, and that is politics.
Oh, do you
we
not?
We just do
it's,
not raise it.
Right.
No, because first of all, I think that my politics have changed over the last few years. I have moved a little further to the left than I was when I was
uh-huh.
younger, and I'm a little bit out of sympathy with some of the sort of ideas that the Conservative Party have put out there. But I think when Cass comes to dinner in my house, that's the last thing he wants to talk about.
Right.
I will say to you that I am immensely proud of him. I think he has done an amazing job, and that at the moment when things are so very, very difficult for him, I've said this many times, like the Prime Minister, the fact that they still go in there, they're still doing
yes.
the job, but they're still trying,
yeah.
I think is in itself quite remarkable. And again, it bothers me that the dialogue about politics has become so terribly strident and so angry and so full of bitterness.
And you see the burnout there, politicians like Jacinda Ardern down in New Zealand.
Absolutely
Leo Varadkar here, 45, thrown in the towel.
Indeed, Nicola Sturgeon, you
yes,
could say,
yes.
had enough of it. And I think if you are relentlessly attacked from the moment you wake up until the moment you go to sleep, when you can't even put on a pair of trainers, for heaven's sake, without
yes.
yards and yards of newspaper articles saying this is the end of Adidas or Nike or whatever
yeah,
it was,
yeah.
you know, it is. Yeah. I think we forget sometimes that these people, I'm not saying that all politicians are lovely, great, intelligent people, but I think the great majority of them have gone into what is, after all, public service
yes.
in order to try and help. And although, again, the newspapers and the media have every right to take them to account, I just think our language, our attitude and the endlessness of it has become destructive.
And it does beg the question, why would you choose that as a career now? And I know public service is part of it,
But Ray, you're putting your finger on one of the biggest problems we now have, which is we have potentially a Labour Party coming into office here with a great many young people who have never known power and we don't know anything about them.
Mm.
And we have also seen for ourselves that a great many Conservative MPs have fallen very, very far and fast because they were not the best people to be in office, clearly.
Yeah.
And I do think that's partly because who in their right minds now would go into politics?
Yeah.
You know, the whole Parliament, to me, seems to need modernisation and need a rethink, like so many things in society.
Anyway, that's for another day. We love an Irish connection here in Ireland. So I was listening to your Desert Island Discs. You worked in advertising before you became a writer. You were a copywriter. And you put put in a pitch for which Irish company, Anthony Horowitz?
Aer Lingus,
yes.
It was. And it was the worst advertising slogan ever created, because all my slogans rhymed, and this one had a sort of quiet desperation about it. It was Aer Lingus, please ring us. That was when I was fired that day.
You didn't get the job, obviously.
You didn't
get the account or whatever. And the other one is Shackleton is a hero of yours.
Very, very much so. I mean, I wrote a very long play about him, and he's been my hero for many, many years. And I wrote him a play about his last attempt to reach the South Pole and to cross Antarctica. And he is the most extraordinary man. The Kenneth Branagh did an absolutely wonderful film about him. I'm sure you saw that. Yes, he's always been my sort of hero in life.
You mentioned about age there earlier on. So 70 is fast approaching, is it?
I fear after last week, I am now in my last year of my 60s, which is a sort of quite scary thought.
Right. Yeah. And does it matter to you?
No, it gives me a certain degree of urgency. Mm. You know, there are books I want to write. We've talked about some of them and things I want to do. And I'm a very, very aware of that closing window. The one thing I'm not worried about death. I am a little bit more worried about some kind of disabling disease.
Illness.
Or losing my capacity in some way. But no, I mean, you know, death is... It's Woody Allen who put the best swing on it, isn't it? Something I won't think about. I just don't want to be there when it happens, he said.
The introduction there, and only part of your work was mentioned. Where do you get the time?
Like the time to do what?
You're so prolific, unbelievably prolific.
But if you're by yourself in a room, it's amazing how long an hour is and how much you can do in an hour. You know, offices and office life is partly designed to fill time. You know, a meeting takes 20 minutes to set up. People arrive. Then they have 20 minutes chatting about what they saw on television. Then they have 20 minutes about sort of talking about the business at hand. Then another 20 minutes talking about what they said. So, you know, the day stretches out very nicely that way and it's all fits. But the intensity of being on your own from sort of 8 in the morning when I start to, it could be 10 o'clock at 11 o'clock at night when I finish, with breaks, of course, walking the dog, going to films, going to theatre, going to libraries, reading, whatever, all that stuff, seeing friends. I have, I think, a nice, happy, cheerful social life, but I do spend an enormous amount of hours on my own and therefore get a lot done.
Yeah. The popularity of true crime, before we let you go, both in written word and podcasting, how do you account for that? Because that's real murders. That's not... You know, murders for entertainment. Although people, you know, it's
well. If you're talking about the shows on some of the streamers about real crime and everything. I'm not personally that drawn to it because I do think that the sort of real crime is so very different to sort of the crimes in my books, which are more intellectual puzzles and entertainment. And I find the idea of people sort of almost like vultures sort of closing in on the corpse and sort of discussing what happened before everything is torn to pieces a little bit... it's just not my taste. I mean, you know, if people love it, I'm not going to criticise them for it, but it's not what I enjoy. I like the separation. I like, you know, the crimes in my books are not crimes that are likely to happen. In close to death, the person is shot with a crossbow, for heaven's sake. You know, that doesn't happen every single day.
And there's odd comedy in it as well.
And comedy and levity and entertainment. And I think, you know, I think that when you take real crime and turn that into entertainment, it's far too easy to forget the actual pain and the horror of murder.
Yes, yeah.
It is...
Just on your writing for television, Midsummer Murders and Foyle's War, what do you watch? Like, you know, have you seen Poker Face, for example? Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that.
No,
you caught me. But there's so much out there.
Yes.
How can one see everything that is there?
I think
at the moment watching The Three-Body Problem. Have you seen any of that?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So I'm
yes.
loving that at the moment.
That's really good, yes. And finally, Anatomy of a Fall.
My favourite film of the year.
Did she do it?
I'd have to see it again. What do you think?
I honestly don't know, and they've been asked, obviously, the writers and director, and then they won't say anything.
You know, you've accidentally demolished one of my arguments. I say that whodunits are great because you always know the ending. You always get that satisfaction of knowing the truth, and it always ends happening. And there is the exception that proves the rule. Brilliant film, though.
Yeah, brilliant film, and a good way to end our chat. Anthony Horowitz's fifth in the Hawthorne series, the fifth of 12, wow, is Close to Death, and it's in a bookshop now. Anthony, lovely talking to you. Mind yourself.
Many thanks, Ray. Lovely talking to you too.
Bye now.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.